So we want to talk about managing patients who are not known to have COVID. And there are several things we want to get into. I think Nair already began to talk a little bit about some of the things that are being done in clinics. And I think it's really going on across the country. We want to talk about COVID testing. And then in particular, the issue of using specific anti-cancer therapies, whether or not that changes the risk of developing COVID or complications from it. And then finally, we get into the issue of the effect of all this on algorithms for management of lung cancer. We'll talk about metastatic disease, stage three inoperable, and adjuvant treatment. So just to begin, Alicia, can you talk a little bit about, at least at MGH, what your criteria is to do COVID testing, assuming a patient doesn't have any symptoms to suggest COVID? In some parts of the country, we're hearing that patients who are starting systemic therapies will be tested. And let me just ask the audience a couple of questions before Alicia responds. So how many patients in your practice, this is for the audience, just click on the answer, how many patients in your practice have either known or suspected COVID and also cancer? So we'll see, you know, we know we have people from all over the country. Alicia, what has your practice been? In some cases, we see people testing for systemic therapy, testing before admission to the hospital for surgery or procedures. What are you doing at MGH?
At MGH, we are testing all patients who are admitted to the hospital because it will have implications about the type of PPE that's used during their care. We're also testing all patients before aerosol-generating procedures are done. So for lung cancer patients, that does include bronchoscopy, and it also includes percutaneous lung biopsies. But for example, for a percutaneous liver biopsy, they do not have to be tested. In the clinic, and as far as delivering therapy, we have the ability to test patients before we start a treatment if we believe that it would be necessary. In the thoracic clinic, we're not really doing that, to be honest, before we start our standard chemotherapy or immune therapy regimens. I believe that my colleagues who are giving more myelosuppressive treatments, maybe in the leukemia lymphoma clinics, are more routinely testing asymptomatic patients before delivering therapy. But for lung cancer patients, we're not doing too much. I will say that the lung cancer patients end up getting a lot of the testing for symptomatic reasons because their tumors have a lot of symptoms that can be confusing or potentially be COVID. So we are testing a lot of our patients with cough, you know, sometimes more than one time to find out if they're positive so that they can be treated and seen in a different area of clinic. We have a specific COVID positive cancer clinic space and infusion space where they're seen if they are positive.
And so we can see here, at least the people who are watching today, more than 80% of them have had a patient with cancer and COVID, and actually about more than a quarter of the audience has had more than four patients. So I don't know if that's civil United States, obviously a very mixed bag across the country. But one other question we want to put out to the audience is about your testing. So we want to ask the audience in general, do you currently test people for COVID if they're asymptomatic? And if they're starting on systemic therapy, do you do it for all systemic new regimens, just for chemotherapy, or you're not testing? Nair, again, what's your approach to testing at Columbia?
I mean, very much similar to, you know, to Alicia. I mean, I think anyone who's, you know, coming in to the hospital, you know, we're testing in anticipation of any treatments, but also for patients who aren't getting treatment, we need to know if they're in the waiting room, what their status is. So patients typically will get seen and temperature checked and sort of screened for symptoms and in the lobby and get tested. And then, we usually get the results back, same day, so we can kind of deal with it accordingly. So,
So, and it looks in terms of the audience, again, I'm sure this is geographic. It could be interesting to see how people vote in different geographic areas, but 2/3 of the audience isn't doing any testing right now, but you can see the results for the others. So we want to kind of drill into a little bit about actual clinical oncology decision-making. But first, before we get into it, Nair, in your presentation that you did that we're going to be posting, you provided a really great overview of sort of kind of the COVID problem. And maybe you could just sort of go through that before we kind of tackle very specific issues, Nair.
Sure. You know, I think as you know, as you mentioned, it's certainly challenging in our lung cancer population where, you know, these, you know, it's a little bit hard to distinguish some of these symptoms that they're having, but certainly many of our patients or majority of their patients, you know, are not having ongoing pulmonary symptoms and so I think any change or new symptoms need to be we aware of, including really anything ranging from cold or fever or dry cough and other non-specific signs to actually severe, you know, pneumonia, ARDS, that can occur in a significant number of infected individuals. One of the issues is really the mortality around, you know, COVID in the general population is much lower than the cancer population. So, you know, leading to a lot of number of studies looking at the influence of chemotherapy or immunotherapy or other treatments. The problem, I think, in our patients is that we give them drugs which cause lung inflammation. And so immune checkpoint inhibitors, you know, we can see pneumonitis in about 2% of cancer patients. It's probably higher in our lung population, more in the order of sort of 4 to 5% range. And tyrosine kinase inhibitors can also cause a pneumonitis pattern. And so we can see these pulmonary infiltrates, which, you know, unlike immunotherapy where you, you know, stop treatment or hold treatment for somebody who's an immune checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis, patients who are on tyrosine kinase inhibitors can have these waxing and waning lung inflammation that we don't necessarily stop treatment as long as they're asymptomatic and not deteriorating. But we can see these infiltrates one scan, then a few months later we can scan them again, you know, they may be gone. So it's definitely been an issue on these therapies.
So Leisha, actually we have a case that we're going to talk about. Unfortunately, I'm not sure where Leora is, but hopefully she's okay. But she had a case that she, actually I met with her yesterday on Zoom and she presented, this is a patient she saw in the last week. But first I'm going to ask the audience how they might think about this clinical situation. So you have a patient with metastatic squamous, presenting with metastatic squamous cell, a TPS of 30, but the patient who's asymptomatic tests positive for COVID. So the question is, what would you do? Would you hold off on treatment and just observe and wait until the COVID, you know, becomes COVID negative? Would you use chemotherapy? Would you use chemotherapy immunotherapy? Would you use immunotherapy alone? And you know, this really gets into the issue, Leisha, of what we know and particularly what we don't know, I think, about the impact of anti-cancer therapies. Leora's talk that she did for us yesterday that we're posting, you know, went through in voluminous detail, the terrible data, lots of data sets that are out there. I don't know that I've seen a whole lot that's super convincing that there is much of a difference. You know, globally, it looks like the mortality is higher, but it's kind of hard to affiliate it with any particular cancer treatment, including local therapies. Alicia, is that your impression?
I think it certainly is early days in terms of what we understand. And a lot of the reports that have come out, I think, are also influenced by regional factors that were outside of their cancer treatment, such as ICU bed availability or, you know, different health and age of different populations. So I think we're still a ways from understanding exactly how the treatment that we're going to give to a patient sitting in front of us in clinic may be impacted or may influence their outcome with COVID. I think it's definitely difficult if you have a patient who you have known positive COVID test. You know, a lot of, more commonly, we're talking about the theoretical chance of COVID in our patients. You know, there's always a chance that the test is not accurate. So, I mean, I think if you have a patient who tests positive, a new diagnosis of cancer, they're not in extremis because of their cancer and could wait a short while, it would be worthwhile to investigate a little more, do a second test, see how they do after a brief period of observation. But ultimately, if they're clinically well, I wouldn't necessarily hold treatment for too long in order to sort that out. But I think we're all still learning.
So it's always interesting when you see a heterogeneity of responses. It looks like in our audience, I'm sure whoever we asked about this case, you're going to see a lot of heterogeneity. So you see everything from just observe the patient to just give chemo, immune, and then both. This is the actual case as it's sort of evolving right now. A 68-year-old patient who was tested positive. He did have initially some symptoms of fatigue, anosmia, but now he's asymptomatic. The patient got retested as it was about to begin treatment with chemo IO and was found to be positive. And she's going to hold off for a little while longer because the patient seems to be stable at this time. Nair, what's your approach to patients? I mean, most of them, as we were saying, do not test positive, but still the concern about the possibility they may develop it. And particularly, Nair, what are your thoughts about chemotherapy? I've heard people say they want to avoid chemo. Of course, everybody wants to avoid infusion, but particularly the issue of neutropenia. Any comments on that, Nair? Any data that we really have on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of data. I mean, some of the data that came out recently in the Lancet last few weeks ago, you know, really suggested that patients did not seem to do, you know, significantly worse if they were, you know, getting treatment versus not. Other areas have shown that if you receive chemotherapy within the last 4 weeks, you can do worse. I mean, I think that, you're giving chemo, which can be myelosuppressive. You're giving steroids, which can, you know, affect your T cells, which are important for, you have an antibody response to the COVID, but you also need a T cell response to be mounted. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be conservative in what you do. I think if patients, you know, like this, if they have a, you know, significant disease burden and need the chemotherapy, then you don't want to, you know, withhold it if they really need it for treatment of their cancer. But you probably, you know, would want to, you know, give them some dose reduction, maybe avoid the corticosteroids and the treatment regimen if you can. And then this patient, if they had small, you know, modest volume disease, you could envision, trying pembrolizumab alone, which is, you know, approved for, you know, patients who have more than 1%, maybe choose the regimen, which you're giving every 6 weeks dosing instead of every 3 weeks to limit coming in. And the other thing, this patient, I mean, you know, he had it 6 weeks ago. I mean, you know, it's a little unusual that he's still, and he's asymptomatic now. One of the cases which I showed you before, Neil, was, you know, a patient who was asymptomatic, had some previous vague fever symptoms a few weeks back, and he was positive, but he also had a very strong antibody positivity. So, it sort of remain positive sort of in an indeterminate level for a couple of weeks after that. And finally, our ID people say his antibody titer is very, very strong. He's probably, you know, okay and safe and not, you know, not infectious, and you don't need to isolate him. So I think that's why you're seeing the sort of diversity of responses. I think that there's a lot to consider for cases like this.
So, Alicia, what about unresectable locally advanced disease? You know, we saw a major advance now in the last couple of years with the addition of IO consolidation with durvalumab. How's your approach to these patients change, both in terms of chemo radiation as well as consolidation durvalumab?
So patients that we're treating with curative intent are the ones that I have tried the hardest to not alter their treatment, or certainly to not put a hold on it. And my radiation oncology colleagues have done the same. It's definitely, when you're going for cure and with locally advanced lung cancer, you know, the odds are still against us, even in the era of durvalumab. So we, you know, we've got to try everything we can. And when we have data that shows actually delays in treatment, particularly delay in starting the durvalumab may lead to worse outcomes, you know, we don't want to do anything to worsen outcomes. So one thing I've done with my maintenance durvalumab patients during this time is actually consider the Q4 week dosing, similar to what Nair was mentioning before about Pembro, since that is now FDA approved as part of the small cell frontline regimen. But otherwise, we've tried not to delay.
That's a really good point. So actually, I think I'll ask Nair this one, although, of course, Alicia is the one I really want to ask. But Nair, we have a question here for the audience I think might be interesting to consider. So let's just put aside regulatory and reimbursement issues. If we can put the slide up, please. I want to know what adjuvant therapy would you likely recommend today for patients stage 2B adenocarcinoma with EGFR19 mutation? That's an easy one, right? Just, hey, Liora, yay. Awesome.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I had faith. I had faith. I knew you were going to be here. You came in the good part. That's okay. You came in the good part, Lior, which is the, we already talked about your case, incidentally, of the patient who was COVID positive. Did you end up treating him yet, or are you still watching?
No, I'm still waiting for him to be negative. I'm curious what other folks said.
Yeah, well, there was a consensus in the audience. Just kidding. They were completely split between observing and treating and what they treated. And I'm not sure we got a consensus out of your colleagues on the faculty, but I was just starting out with Nair, but I think I'm going to flip over to you, Lior, since you're here. We were talking about metastatic disease. We were talking about locally advanced. I want to know about adjuvant. And I imagine the answers to all these questions would vary based on kind of what the situation is COVID-wise in your area. And I know, Lior, of course, your situation in Nashville is, I guess, a lot better than it is, say, in some of the other areas that are seen to be hotspots right now. But Lior, are you still, what are you doing right now for a patient like this who's got an exon 19 mutation? Are you sticking with, we'll put aside reimbursement, chemo? Want to go chemo osimertinib? Want to say, hey, let's skip the infusions, reduce your risk of COVID, just go with OC? What do you think, Lior?
Yeah, I think chemo still has an important role for these patients. And so I would vote for the chemotherapy followed by osimertinib and sort of have that discussion with the patient, kind of like we did with the Pacific data, saying we know it may decrease the risk of the cancer coming back. We're not sure how it's going to impact overall survival. But I don't think that we should not give these patients chemotherapy. I think that chemotherapy is still an important part of their treatment.
And, you know, Alicia, you know, we talked about this, of course, and I talked with Tom Lynch about it also, you know, the fact that we only have disease-free survival now, but of course, wow, what a hit, you know, a hazard rate, I guess, less than 0.2, depending which one you use. I was trying to remember, what's the hazard rate for decreased risk of recurrence with chemo? Alicia, I doubt that it's that low.
Yeah, it's about a 5% improvement in cure rate.
But hazard rate-wise, more in the 20%?
0.7, 0.75, depending on the study.
Right. So anyhow, interestingly, the most common answer of the audience, Alicia, is OC alone.
Yeah.
I assume that, I guess that's related to COVID, but I don't know. Alicia, what are your thoughts? Are you staying with the tried and true chemo and now followed by OC?
I would definitely recommend staying with the tried and true chemo. I'm guessing that some people are favoring osimertinib alone because Dr. Herbst showed a slide at ASCO and post-hoc analysis of patients who did get adjuvant chemo and how they did with OC versus placebo, and patients who didn't get adjuvant chemo and how they did with OC and placebo. And the benefit to osimertinib was seen across both groups, but that doesn't mean that the chemo should be omitted. Certainly for a stage 2 patient, you know, chemotherapy has a long track record, not just for DFS, but for OS. So I would recommend giving chemotherapy first to a patient like this, but I would also strongly recommend giving osimertinib after that.
Actually, I was just flashing on a project we presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting where we asked 25 breast cancer researchers to say, just tell us what numbers you would give to a patient about adding various HER2 regimens on in the, just don't tell us what you do, just tell us what numbers. I love to do that and see what numbers you all would give, you know, best guess about what the long-term impact would be in this situation. And yeah, I just want to bring in one other issue. And Leora, you went through this in detail in your talk. And of course, the Terabolt Registry initiative, which maybe you can just kind of summarize a bit, was an incredible activity that you were very much involved with. And was presented at ACR and ASCO. But maybe you could just sort of summarize in general what we've learned, Leora, about COVID and lung cancer and how it affects prognosis and mortality.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's been so much conflicting data, and, you know, a lot of it is affected by these retrospective reviews as opposed to a lot of prospective data, but it's the best that we have right now. And for Terravolt, what we found specifically to thoracic cancer is, so some different data emerging depending on the tumor type. One is that thoracic cancer patients, the mortality is much higher than what we see for the general cancer population. It's around 35% in the general cancer population. It seems to be less than 20%. We also saw in Terravolt that less of the thoracic cancer patients were admitted to the ICU, and we don't know if some of the factors affecting that have to do with some of the resources and constraints that Europe was facing. You know, the Memorial Sloan Kettering data said that 24% of patients were admitted to ICU, so much higher than the 8% that we saw in Terravolt. The factors that are associated with increased risk of ICU, as well as, more importantly, increased risk of mortality, were older age over 65, an ECOG performance status of 1 or worse. Patients were on chemotherapy or chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Actually, the hazard ratio for patients on TKIs was 0.28. So, and with chemo being sort of the baseline comparator, so much, much lower for patients who are on TKIs. And so, you know, what this has made us think about in terms of treating our patients, you know, I still think we need to treat our patients with the best regimen. So if they should get chemo, they should get chemo IO, that's what we should do. But also a lot of the patients, some of their points of contact were within the healthcare system. It was not what CCC19 indicated was half of those patients got exposed at home. And so can we minimize patients' interactions, specifically with thoracic malignancies, with the healthcare environment? So keep them at home, give pembrolizumab every 6 weeks, give nivolumab once a month, durvalumab once a month, so that we're minimizing how often these patients actually have to come into the healthcare environment.
I guess another issue that's come out is obviously a gigantic one, Leora, and we were chatting about this yesterday, is the issue of telemedicine, and particularly, you know, whether or not it's going, you know, we'll be able to continue getting reimbursement. I know there have been some questions about that in Tennessee, although I can't seem to find any other issues around the country. Leora, any other comments about, you know, ways to minimize risk for patients in terms of not only the choice of therapy, but the procedures that are being used in clinics?
Yeah, so I'm curious if Leisha and I are having the same thing where telemedicine is sort of fading away here and we're being asked to bring our patients back. Also, some states that are rescinding our licenses as of July 8th. So we touched 10 different states here in Tennessee, and suddenly those patients are not going to be allowed to do telemedicine. You know, we see some practices, we don't do it, where they're doing weekly labs on lung cancer patients on chemotherapy. That needs to stop. You know, the patients who are getting frequent CT scans, maybe they don't need to get those CT scans as frequently. For many of our patients, especially when they're stable, we're scanning them every 3 months. We're not scanning them every 6 weeks. Also, when they come into the different centers, sort of, is there one place where they get their labs and infusion? A lot of centers will have patients come get their labs on one day, see the doctor, but then they have to come back another day to get their therapy. So I realize that we're spoiled at our institution, but are there some of those things that we can do? And reminding our patients, you know, I have a lot of patients who are suddenly saying they want to fly, they want to go see their grandchildren, that COVID is, the country's opening, but COVID is also opening across the country. And so it is not safe. They still need to be really cautious and stay home and stay away from people. Because their risk factors and their risk of mortality, you know, you get cured, quote unquote, with immunotherapy only to die from COVID, which one could argue in some cases with some of the risky behavior is an avoidable thing for some of these patients.